So we now hand over to Brother Luke speaking on the prophecy of Obadiah.
Thank you very much, Will. Dear brothers and sisters, it's lovely to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation to speak. It's my first visit, and hopefully we can share together in some thoughts relating to Obadiah. I should just say at the outset, I'm just coming on the back off the back of a quite bad cold, so I'm hopeful that my voice will last, and apologies in advance if things get a little croaky towards the end. So Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament, as we're probably all aware, but it's no slouch. And in fact, I originally considered this subject over a couple of sessions, and I've tried to condense it down into one, and it's quite the challenge. There's so much to explore within it. We're going to try and rattle through as much as we can tonight, although sadly there will have to be some things left unsaid. You'll notice that I think in the official subject was just Obadiah, but I think it's kind of implicit that it has to be the prophecy of Obadiah, because when it comes to considering the man Obadiah, we have next to nothing to go on. It's fairly typical, isn't it, for a prophecy to commence with a short introduction that introduces us to the prophet and gives us a little bit of context. It tells us where they're from. It tells them which king. It tells us which king that they were prophesying to, or in the time of. Mike is an example there on the screen. Another example there in Zechariah. And you know, we normally get this context and some form of indication as to their purpose, their audience, and so on. With Obadiah, we simply told this is the vision of Obadiah, and then it's straight in. So there is very little that we can glean from this book about Obadiah, the man. And the name Obadiah appears 13 times, but it appears to cover a range of different people. In fact, it's linked to the name Abdullah, which, as we all know, is a common Muslim name. It's not unusual to find people with this name. Now, the Jewish Talmud, for what it's worth, describes this Obadiah as a converted Edomite, a descendant of Eliphaz, and suggests that he was chosen for this particular task, because, as I'm sure we've noticed, the prophecy relates to Edom, because of his heritage. Now, we take that at face value, but clearly cannot give it the same credence as we give Scripture. It's an observation and nothing more. But it is interesting, isn't it, that there's more written about Melchizedek than there is about Obadiah, the man. And I have to say, normally when you come across these situations, it tends to strike me that that's probably deliberate. We're probably deliberately not expected to understand more about Obadiah, the man, and the context that we might expect. Like with Melchizedek, where there's something we can glean from that, I think it's probably intentional that we have limited detail, and we'll perhaps, you know, touch on that again as we go, time permitting. So we have limited information about Obadiah the man, and we have limited information about the context. So if we were to try and understand the timing of this prophecy and to understand the audience that it might have, that's quite a challenge. And indeed, there is lots of debate about that. There are suggestions that it's a prophecy that's been added to over time. What can we glean about the potential timing and audience, given that, you know, ultimately we have to go with what the scriptures say without putting much credence outside? Well, it might seem that the it's triggered by events of the past relating to the captivity of Israel. For example, in the King James that I've got here, verse 3, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the cliffs of the rock." Jumping down to verse 11, "In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them." So there's perhaps a hint in the language that we've got here that this is something relating to an event in the past that involved the captivity of Edom's brother, Jacob, or Israel. And our minds might naturally turn to the Babylonian captivity around 586 BC. And there are passages that highlight that Edom had a part to play in the suffering there. Psalm 137, verse 7, "Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, 'Raise it, even to the foundation thereof.'" They egged the Babylonians on, and they added to Judah's misery. And there is wide support for the prophecy being written post-exile. However, as you might expect, there are potential issues with this timing and other schools of thought. I'm not a Hebrew linguist and can only pass on what I've read, but apparently the prophecy is written in an older form of High Hebrew. I don't quite know what that means, to be honest, but I think the idea is that it's, you know, an older form of the language, which would seem to push the date back rather than the sort of post-exilic time period. And there's also quite a few links with Jeremiah, particularly chapter 49. Keep a finger in Obadiah. You might want a marker in it, because glad to the time if we have to wait to turn it up all the time. But if you just go to Jeremiah chapter 49... And if we just pick up at verse 7, concerning Edom, that makes sense, concerning Edom, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, is with them no more in Teman," and so he goes on. And particularly, if we might notice verse 9, "If grape gatherers come to thee, would they not leave some gleaning grapes?" And we may have noticed in Obadiah verse 5, "If thieves come to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes?" So we've kind of got the same thing there. Likewise, back in Jeremiah verse 14, "I have heard a rumour from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent unto the heathen, saying, gather ye together and come against her, and rise up to the battle." And the opening verse of Obadiah said, "We have heard a rumour from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle." Those couple of examples. Jeremiah appears to quote or allude to several verses from Obadiah. And I guess this opens up a debate as to which came first. I said that Jeremiah quoted Obadiah, but did Obadiah quote Jeremiah? And therefore, does Obadiah come before or after the time of Jeremiah? Well, Jeremiah, we're not going to study this at length, but Jeremiah intertwines Obadiah's words with his own. They're not direct word-for-word translations like we might find between sort of Micah and Isaiah, for example, which perhaps suggests it's a bit more of a commentary. He's sort of taken Obadiah's words and sort of added a bit of commentary around them, although it's fair to say that he also omits some points that might have aided his case. So it's interesting that... you know, it's not a direct citation, but it perhaps just hints that Jeremiah is working with the words of Obadiah, and if that is supported by the linguistics, which, like I say, I'm no expert on, it would perhaps suggest that Jeremiah is quoting Obadiah rather than the other way around. And Obadiah is also referenced by a number of other prophets. It's also fair to say, we'll have noted perhaps as we read through Obadiah, that it doesn't have any relevant context to a post-exilic point of writing. There's no references to Nebuchadnezzar or Babylon or earlier historical events that we might perhaps have expected somebody writing at that time to mention. Not in itself evidence of anything, but it's an observation. And perhaps the most challenging thing we might say, well, what about all this past tense, etc.? Well, it's worth noting, and I don't know if you've got an ESV Bible, you may have already spotted this, but we're probably aware that Hebrew tenses are very different to English. In fact, they don't have the concept of the tense that the English has, the past tense. And the words aren't actually specific to the past. And if we look in other translations, what we find is that these words, these verbs, are actually in the imperative form. They're like commands. Do not gloat, rather than having gloated. Do not rejoice. Do not boast. Do not enter. So actually, that almost flips it around, and it's almost a sense of Obadiah giving a warning about future calamities and future situations, whilst perhaps also reflecting a consistent attitude towards Israel. He's warning of things that people always do against Israel, and saying that, you know, history shouldn't repeat itself. And I think the conclusion I sort of came to on this really was that this is sort of fits with what is probably a reasonably established principle of prophecies having multiple applications and multiple cycles. There are many prophecies that we can clearly pinpoint to specific events and a specific point in time, but there are also those where we see repeated cycles, isn't there? There's times where we see a set of events unfolding, and then we see another set of events that sort of mirror the first, and, you know, sometimes we then see that same set of events in future prophecies which are yet to unfold. And perhaps this starts to fit in a little bit with the idea that there is so little context attached to the prophecy, that actually we're perhaps in the domain more of principles than specifics. And we'll see how if we can develop that a bit further as we go. But in short, it would seem to me that it's probably a pre-exilic prophecy, but with some deliberate ambiguity in there. Okay, so we're going to sort of start to look at the prophecy a bit now. And I've sort of lumped quite heavily the first 14 verses into this initial section, "Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom," because this is a prophecy about Edom. And God targets their character, calls out their pride, and their actions against Israel. And so I think to sort of appreciate the points being made, we need to have a little look at Edom and consider their nature. It's notable, isn't it, that we've got these two lines of attack, and it's not uncommon in Scripture to find repeating something to be a form of emphasis. So you think, for example, the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God. And there's a Hebrew form of the language where if you repeat the word, it's kind of a form of emphasis. So it seems that, you know, this is all about Edom, and their, whether it's their character or their actions, it's really drawing emphasis towards what God has established. So what of Edom then? The word Edom is more or less the same as the word Adam. You can see there's just a minor difference between the two words there, but it means red, as we perhaps know, and it's associated with that earthly mortality. Adam was made of the dust of the ground, wasn't he? And it was, of course, the name given to Esau. We're told in Genesis 25 that Esau is Edom. Let's just turn there again, back in Obadiah, but let's just turn to Genesis 25. It's an event that I'm sure we're all familiar with. It probably features fairly early on in our life in Sunday school, etc. It's one of those familiar early stories where Esau is interacting with his brother Jacob. And we'll note in Genesis 25 verse 24, when her days were to be delivered and fulfilled, this is Rebecca, of course, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau, not Edom, but Esau. And after that, his brother came out and took hold on Esau's heel, and so on. And then we have this incident, don't we, with Esau became a cunning hunter, Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents, and then Jacob sought pottage, verse 29. Esau came from the field and was faint, and Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom, verse 30. So his name was changed to Edom. Not, it wasn't given Edom at birth, but was given it later on. Now, that context of the redness in verse 30 is in the context of this red pottage. Now, the word pottage is in italics, and actually what's in the Hebrew there is red. It's a repeated word, emphasis again, Adam. So Edom is given this nickname of... Esau is given this name meaning red. And we might think it's because of him coming out red. You might think it's because of the red pottage. But actually, I wonder if it's something else. Because what encapsulated Esau? Well, as he went on in this event, he talks to Jacob and he asks him to sell him this pottage for the price of his birthright. And Jacob did so. And he gave him, verse 34, bread and pottage of lentils. And Esau despised his birthright. And perhaps what this event shows more than ever is the lust and pride of Esau. Because if we read on into chapter 26, what do we read? There was a famine in the land. So this food was in short supply. This wasn't just an average meal, and Esau came back and he hadn't had time to prepare dinner, and do you mind me having some of yours? This was a scarce resource, and Esau wanted it for himself. And he wasn't really, although of course we know it wasn't the long term, he wasn't really giving Jacob anything in return for it. Jacob couldn't feed off the birthright, could he? And of course that was extremely significant in the longer term. But this was a man who wasn't quite prepared to take food out of the mouth of his brother. So we're reading a little bit into it there, but it feels to me like he probably denied Jacob a meal as a result of this. And perhaps this is the first recorded instance of Esau depriving his brother at a time of need. And that, to me, that characteristic, that self-serving, lusty characteristic, the earthy mortality, feels like it's at the heart of why Esau is Edom. Not because he looked red or because he fancied this red pottage, although clearly that all seems to tie in together, but it's this attitude, this self-serving character of living in the moment. Of course, he wasn't thinking ahead with the birthright either, was he? He was quite happy to throw away those long-term gains in return for that immediate satisfaction. And this is what is singled out in Obadiah, isn't it? In Obadiah and verse 3, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. It's the pride of thine heart that is really being called out with Edom. And what of pride? Proverbs 6 verse 16, these six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination to him, a proud look, a lying tongue, and so on. And he says in Malachi, doesn't he, I hated Esau. Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord? Yes, I loved Jacob and I hated Esau. That's a really strong thing to say, isn't it? That's the depth of the breadth of the chasm that this proud outlook put between Esau and God. And this pride is something that developed further over time as his descendants settled and formed the nation of Edom. And when it comes to their territory, my point is on the blink, so I can't point, but hopefully you can all see it clearly there at the bottom. Edom settled in the area to the south of Israel, an area including Mount Seir, after seeing off the Horites, which we read about in Deuteronomy 2, the area that's sort of modern-day Jordan. And this is one of the driest parts of the Middle East. They were heavily reliant upon well-crafted water and irrigation systems to have the opportunity to feed off the land. And you can probably just make out at the bottom there, Petra, this was their capital. Selah, this was the capital city, and the word Selah or Petra means rock. You probably see why. It was a real stronghold. And many of them lived in caves due to the heat. It's the only way to get relief from the scorching heat. And it says in Obadiah verse 3, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock. The word Selah or Petra there, rock, whose habitation is high. And it was a place that was literally red. It was described by poet John William Bergen as a rose-red city half as old as time. It was accessed by its main entrance to the east, which is called the Sick or Shaft, And just to give a sense of the scale there, you just sort of see, you know, people and just how enormous this was. This is a towering fortress. And you can understand why this would have given them a huge confidence in their ability to defend themselves. I mean, who's, you know, in an age long before the weapons, the explosive weapons of today, how on earth was anybody going to penetrate such incredibly naturally strong territory as this? And we sort of get that sense again in verse 3 of Obadiah. Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? This was that proud, arrogant confidence that Edom had in their ability to defend themselves. Goes on in verse 4, though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. And the word eagle there is actually, it's the griffin, vulture. This is slightly different to the eagle. They nest right on the highest crags. Eagles will sometimes come down lower, but the griffin vulture, it nests right on the highest crag, and right at the highest possible point was where Edom saw themselves, amongst the stars. So it's just no wonder, you know, they were a proud nation, confident in their own abilities. This was the very heart of their self-confidence. But what does Obadiah go on to say? Well, they were going to be completely destroyed. Verse 6, how are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? It goes on that verse 7, the men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread have laid a wound under thee. There is none understanding in him. Shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. There's a little bit of wordplay in some of these verses, just for what it's worth. A few of the words that we have through these early verses, the word envoy or ambassadors is in the King James. It is the word seer in verse 1, and think of Mount Seir. We've got the word rock in verse 3, which is Selah. And the phrase grape gatherers that we had in verse 5 is Bozrah, which is akin to the city of Bozrah, just as a little aside there. So this mightily proud nation, epitome of the flesh and fleshly thinking, was going to come crashing down despite all apparent natural defences, and every one of them would be cut off by slaughter. Now, this wasn't just for their pride alone, was it? As Obadiah goes on to talk about, there was a very specific act they were guilty of, which was their treatment of Israel. We've already referred, haven't we, in Genesis 25, which we won't go back to that initial conflict and to that depriving of his brother that Esau does. And right back in the womb, of course, they had that incident with the heel. But not despite that, you know, there were some clear expectations. In fact, I've got this on the screen, we don't need to look it up. Some clear expectations on Israel, at least, as to how they should behave. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7, thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. So despite the fact the way he may have been treated, you shouldn't abhor him. That was the expectation on Israel. And again, in Deuteronomy talking a bit about them, the important point is made to meddle not with them. Now, did Edom reciprocate? They weren't privy to the law, but did they reciprocate? Well, no, of course not. We had that initial conflict, didn't we? And then as we read through the accounts of Israel, we find time and time again that Edom mistreated his brother. We had the unprovoked refusal to allow Israel to pass through their land in Numbers chapter 20. Israel was, you know, conscious of the demands they were making and determined, you know, we'll stay on the highway and we don't cause you any ill will. No, Edom wasn't having it. You know, and with such great defences as we've seen, what did they have to fear? This nomadic tribe who just stumbled out of captivity, you know, why would they have anything to fear? This is pure spite to block their passage. We have the later battles under Saul in 1 Samuel. We have battles under David when Edom was brought into subjection and very nearly destroyed. We have then Hadad's uprising and challenge to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 11. We then have a confederacy in 2 Chronicles chapter 20 with Moab and Ammon at the time of Jehoshaphat. In 2 Chronicles 20 that was. And then finally on this little list that we've got here, and I may have missed some along the way, we've got a rebellion that took place under Jehoram, who was of course Jehoshaphat's son. And perhaps we'll just turn that one up in 2 Chronicles chapter 21. So this is coming after the confederacy that happened at the time of Jehoshaphat. So sort of next generation with his son. And in verse 8, in his days, so this is just a context, verse 1 of chapter 21, Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers, Jehoram his son reigned in his stead. Verse 8, in his days the Edomites revolted from under the dominion of Judah and made themselves a king. So they got themselves, they had this rebellion, they got themselves a new king. And if we just read on to verse 16, moreover, the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines and of the Arabians that were near the Ethiopians, and they came up into Judah and brake into it, and carried away all the substance that was found in the king's house, and his sons also and his wives, so that there was never a son left him, save Jehoahaz, the youngest of his sons. So what we have here is a captivity, isn't it? We have a captivity that Obadiah referred to in verse 11. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that Edom had rebelled and broken away from the accord that they had with Jehoram and Israel at that time, and then stood by and watched and laughed as the Israelites were taken into a form of captivity by the Philistines and the Arabians. And perhaps this is where Obadiah's prophecy slots in. Maybe it was written around this time. We have said, of course, that we can't read too much into the tenses, but maybe Obadiah is writing on the back of the lessons to be learned from that particular captivity, and using the occasion as a context to guard against the repeat of that in the future. Well, it was Edom's failings, wasn't it, on both these two fronts, their pride and their treatment of Israel, that was the cause of their ultimate downfall. And again, just to whiz through the history of Edom, they were overthrown by Nebuchadnezzar, who was a former ally of theirs, and Obadiah referred to that, didn't he, in verse 7, the men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee. They were overthrown by Nebuchadnezzar, who placed them in the south of Judah, which is where they were when the Jews returned under Zerubbabel. And they became known actually as Idumeans, and we find them referred to in Mark 3 and verse 8. They were also conquered by Judas Maccabeus, the Maccabees, for a while around 163 BC, and again by John Hyrcanus in about 125 BC, and forced to embrace Judaism despite the opposition of the Pharisees. So they are very much already removed from their stronghold and their might and their power. We know that the dynasty of the Herods that we have in the New Testament were Idumeans, a dynasty that was in place until AD 70. And in fact, 20,000 Idumeans allied with the Zealots in the run-up to AD 70 in a siege of the temple, which ended in a rampage through Jerusalem. And then, of course, we have the Jewish downfall in AD 70, which was in large part due to the factional infighting that was taking place, including Jews and Idumeans. It seemed that they were more concerned about fighting each other rather than fighting a common enemy, which is perhaps food for thought for some of the challenges we might find ourselves in ecclesial life from time to time. And then they were completely destroyed in the aftermath of AD 70. and any remaining identity that they may have had was absorbed into Israel, and they completely disappear from history. There is no identifiable remnant, just as Obadiah had prophesied. So appreciate we're sort of rattling through this at pace, but moving on so this has sort of brought us down to verse 15. I'm conscious we haven't stopped and read every single verse. We've obviously read through it in advance, and I think we've talked through the points here around the few verses there. I don't think we'd read 10 to 14, but I was making the point there about looking on in the day of their brother being taken into captivity. And so we come to verse 15, where the prophecy sort of shifts gears a little bit, because it now says, the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. So what we're finding is actually this judgment upon Edom is now being extended to all the heathen. The scope is widening. It's extending to all the heathen. And actually, if you look back into those previous verses, 11 to 14, you'll notice that the phrase, the day, appears quite a lot. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away, verse 12, thou shouldst not have looked on the day of thy brother, in the day that he became a stranger, neither should thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah, in the day of their destruction, neither should thou have spoken about in the day of distress, and so on. It appears 10 times in relation to the day that Edom exploited Jacob, which is what those verses are talking about. But now we come to another day. And this isn't the day of Edom. This is the day of the Lord. Each of those previous instances of the day was followed by an aspect of Judah's suffering. The day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, or the day of him becoming a stranger, or the day of their destruction, or the day of their distress. This day is followed by the name of God to highlight the nature of divine judgment. Sorry, to highlight the divine nature of this judgment. This wasn't another Edom. This is the Lord. And this day involves the Lord. It's a phrase, the day of the Lord, I'm sure we're all familiar with and aware, appears in numerous places throughout both Testaments, but primarily, particularly amongst prophecies. And we find it in Isaiah, in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Zephaniah, Zechariah, and Malachi. And considering its usage does sort of present a certain consistency. Here's just a few examples. Against the proud, this is the day of the Lord is described about as a time that's against the proud and lofty, or against Babylon following the captivity, or in Isaiah 34, against all nations. We get references to it as applying to Israel's, in the context of Israel's deliverance, so it's kind of judgment and deliverance combined together. Zechariah 14, we have all the nations gathered against Jerusalem in the day of the Lord. Zephaniah 2 lists judgments on specific nations in the context of the day of the Lord. Zephaniah 1 talks about the punishment of Judah and the way in which those who had turned from the Lord would be judged, and those who didn't would be okay. So this is a concept which is throughout these prophecies, rather than being anything specific to Obadiah. And do they all relate to a specific point in time or to different times? Well, Obadiah says it's near upon all the heathen, or it's approaching upon all the heathen. It's talking about imminent events. But of course, you know, we're told quite clearly in Scripture, aren't we? In Luke chapter 17, it talks about the days will come when ye shall desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man. And there is no single day of the Lord, is there? We read about this concept multiple times, and these are different events that involve divine judgment, divine intervention. And as we study and examine the individual incidents, we often find there's a pattern to them. There's a similar method of operation that God uses, you know, for example, causing confusion amongst the enemies so they turn amongst themselves. And this kind of ties back into what we were saying earlier on about Obadiah perhaps being a prophecy of principles focused upon a set of criteria, a set of events that actually aren't limited to a single point in time, but could be applied at multiple points in time, just as this Day of the Lord concept can be applied again and again and again to slightly different situations, but following the same pattern. So too, the lessons and the warnings in Obadiah can be seen to have this broader context. The Day of the Lord being near upon all the heathen applies any time that God avenges those who follow Edom, those who proudly oppose his ways and his people, whatever era that might be in, whatever the time is, the judgment is not too far away. It's near, it's approaching. Now if, and it is an if the prophecy of Obadiah does slot in around the time of Jehoram, and I'm conscious there's no real substantial evidence for that, it's purely a thought, but if it slotted in around then, that would make this, I think, the phrase's earliest usage in the scriptures. And perhaps that ties in with Obadiah maybe, you know, being quoted by Jeremiah and some of the other prophets. Maybe this is a concept Obadiah is presenting which other prophets pick up on and flesh out further and develop and use in other situations. Just one final comment on the Day of the Lord. It's really interesting to explore the links between Edom and Babylon in the context of the Day of the Lord. That has to be for another day. There's no way we can cover that in the time that we've got. But suffice it to say, you know, this clearly has an application, doesn't it? Not only to the past days of the Lord, but to that future Day of the Lord and Armageddon and all the events that we await, which you know. Is approaching, isn't it? And we hope is near. So this final section then of the prophecy, verses 17 to 21, having presented the specific judgment upon Edom, having broadened that out to all nations, all those who are acting as Edom has done, and therefore are recipients of the same judgment, we now have a change in tone in that it's focusing now on the victory of Jacob over Edom. Still very much a judgment on Edom. Edom have been defeated, but it's elevating Jacob and highlighting the deliverance and the victory. And there's an interesting interplay between houses and mounts as we read through these verses. Just worth noting in verse 8, shall I not in that day, saith the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. So every one of the mount of Edom was to be destroyed. And by contrast, on verse 70, those on Mount Zion, upon Mount Zion, shall be deliverance and there shall be holiness. So this is a very different situation. On this particular mount, we have deliverance rather than destruction. And we're told that the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions, Edom's possessions. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau, well, they'll be stubble. They shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it. So the house of Jacob or the house of Joseph will devour the house of Esau. And verse 19, they of the south shall possess the mount of Esau, and they of the plain the Philistines, and they shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. And the captivity of this host of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath. And the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. So the Mount of Esau and the surrounding nations will be possessed by Israel and those of the south. Now, when we think about mounts and houses, we typically tend to think about, in the case of the mount, the government or the ruling power, and perhaps with the house, we think of the people. And so what we're seeing here is a clear picture painted of how that the government would be overthrown, the Mount of Edom, as a representative for whoever these judgments apply to, whether it's Edom in the first instance, whether it's Babylon, other nations, the ruling power will be overthrown, and the people, the remnant of the house, well, they lived on initially, but then they were absorbed into Israel. When we look at that in the context of the captivity, for example, that's precisely what we see. Babylon overthrew Edom, and the Edomites lived on a bit longer, but eventually were absorbed into the house of Israel, the people that they lived amongst, until they lost their identity. So we have the ruling power going, and then the people being absorbed. And when we think about that as a broader application and project forward, perhaps, you know, we see the same thing at Armageddon, don't we? The beast will lose its power at Armageddon, but its adherents will survive until the second death. There will still be a degree of mortality, and then it's finally lost its identity altogether. The mounts and the houses are applicable to Edom and elsewhere as well. In fact, we see this brought out in Daniel chapter 7. I beheld, even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame, as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. And this is the big picture, isn't it? That we know that the world's governments will change, Christ will return, all the governments of the world will be overthrown, and the people will be given the opportunity to live on under that jurisdiction. But eventually, you know, any degree of uprising, any degree of any sense of the flesh living on will be shut down until God is truly all and in all, just as happened with Edom. So, as we've alluded to throughout, really, I think when it comes to reflecting on this prophecy of Obadiah, it strikes me that what we see is a set of principles. That there's obviously an application that's specific to Edom, and perhaps the point of it being written to a particular point in time. But perhaps the way this prophecy is captured and recorded and presented to us, we have presented this set of principles that really applies to all ages. And perhaps that's why we have the ambiguity, because this is a bit of a template prophecy, perhaps, that we can read in the context of multiple points in history. We're given in it a really strong reassurance that God has a purpose with his people which nothing can get in the way of. You may be able to oppress them for a time, but the clock is ticking, and that day of the Lord is coming. It's approaching, it's near, when it will no longer be tolerated. He will cut off all opponents, however proud and confident they are, whatever defences they think they've got. They will be cut off. They are guaranteed to face his judgments. And you know, this is applicable, isn't it, to it's a recurring theme of prophecy, these principles. What causes people to act in this way? Well, they're motivated by the pride of the flesh, aren't they? And we probably need to look no further than the House of Commons right now to see how man will act to try and get his way. He will stop at nothing. He'll find every trick in the book to get what he wants. Edom, of course, was the original anti-Semite. He was the first person, it would seem, to oppress his brother Jacob. And he has a notable history that's recorded throughout the scriptures as we've whizzed through. But of course, anybody is capable of the same fleshly thinking, because pride, that root cause, that trust in oneself rather than God, is really what's being judged here, isn't it? Edom was a clear manifestation of it, but it's not by any means something that we can look at and see, well, that's Edom's problem, but it's not mine. This is something that applies to all those who demonstrate the same fleshly thinking. And it's seen throughout all nations over the years. And history has shown us, hasn't it, how God has been true to his word thus far. And of course, that final uprising, that final destruction, that day of the Lord upon all the heathen, well, we still await it, don't we? We still look and long for that time when no longer is it individual nations, individual situations, but once and for all, it will be stamped out, and that that ultimate overthrow of the ways of the flesh is enacted. We await that future day of the Lord and the final fulfillment of these things. Just as our closing thought, if we go back to the Song of Moses in Exodus chapter 15, right at Israel's earliest stage as a nation, we find some similar sentiments. Exodus chapter 15 and verse 11. Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? Thou stretchest out thy right hand, the earth swallowed them. Thou in thy mercy hast led forth the people which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them in thy strength unto thy holy habitation. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed, or terrified, as the word is. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. There's no more pride now, is there? Where are these strong defences? What are these strong defences doing for you now? They're trembling. They're melting away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. By the greatness of thine arm, they shall be as still as a stone, till thy people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over, which thou hast purchased. And what then? Thou shalt bring them in and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance. This is the mount that prevails, isn't it? This is not the Mount of Edom, this is Mount Zion. Thou shalt plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thee to dwell in the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. These are words which were spoken in Israel's earliest days as a nation. And to an extent they were fulfilled, partially, time and time again. But we await their full and final fulfillment, don't we, brothers and sisters, when, as verse 18 says, the Lord shall reign forever and ever.